to everything that's gay. If you are not the to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
Hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Billy Collins. His books include Nine Horses, published by Random House in 2002, Sailing Alone Around the Room, New and Selected Poems, 2001, Picnic Lightning, 1998, The Art of Drowning, 1995, which was a finalist for the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize, Questions About Angels, 1991, which was selected by Edward Hirsch for the National Poetry Series, The Apple That Astonished Paris, 1988, Video Poems, 1980, and Poker Face, 1977. He's here today to talk about The Trouble with Poetry and Other Poems, published by Random House. Hi, Billy.
Hi.
Great to have you on again.
Likewise. I'm glad we could make this connection.
Me too. Talk about this book. I was reading it, and I don't know if it's just me, but it seemed to me that some of the poems were longer than usual, than say, Nine Horses. Is that true, or am I just imagining things?
Well, that would be a change, wouldn't it? that's something to notice. They're longer. Maybe the next one will be shorter. I don't really know.
Do you think about that? I guess
okay,
is what I'm
wondering.
Okay,
let me dwell on that for a few minutes. I don't really write books of poems. I just write one poem at a time. And I'm never thinking about, okay, this is going to go into this book and be accompanied by the poem I wrote last week. So it's really just like one song at a time. It's like cuts on a record. And the only time I put a book together is not when I think I have this great book that in which the poems belong. You know, they're welded together in some group. I just put a book together when I have enough poems that would add up to a book, and I think they're all, you know, they're all keepers. So I don't have some overarching sense of what the book is all about. It's just basically this book is the poems I've been, the best poems I think I've written over the past couple of years.
So then you said when you think you have a book's worth of keepers, how many don't make it in?
Well, at this point in my writing, I usually throw out any like B material, and I just try to keep the A stuff. The other stuff just goes in the wastebasket. So anything that's on my desk or that I send out to a magazine, I pretty much would stand by. So it's not so much sorting out like the A, B, and C poems. Well, it's all gold, you know what I mean? I mean, it's just, you want to get the 14-karat gold in the book.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and I imagine that at this point, you know when it's 14-karat and when it's simply, gold-filled.
You know, I do know. I mean, I think that's something that I didn't know and probably, beginning poets in their first stages don't know. There's that you know, in very early writing, young writing, there's that horrible fixation you have with your own work where the fact that you wrote it somehow makes it good. But that's something to be shed as quickly as possible. I do know, yeah. In fact, I don't really bother getting past the second stanza with a poem that I realize is not going to work really well.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I recognize momentum, you know what I mean? Like, I get a little notion, and then I think, you know, either this has some run to it, it has some potential momentum, or it doesn't. It just kind of wanders down some side street, and then it dies a natural death.
So you'll easily throw something away, or do you put it in a drawer just in case it has a line or an image?
Oh, no, it goes away. It goes bye-bye right into the wastebasket. You know, writing workshops, there's a lot of bad advice, and someone should have a book of really bad advice you hear in writing workshops. One of them is, oh, no, don't throw that away. Save that, you know, for another poem. You know, it's a really good image, so just put that aside, like spare parts, you know. I think it's terrible advice because I can recognize from about 100 yards a poem that's been constructed of the spare parts of other rejected poems. And you get a sense that the poem is together only because of duct tape. You know, it's just super glue, duct tape, something is holding it together. But there's no organic flow. You don't get the sense that this poem is the result of a continuous experience that happened in real time with the author's imagination. And that's why I try to write poems in one sitting, 10 minutes, half an hour and 15 minutes, you know, whatever it takes, but just to sit down and make sure you go from beginning, middle to end in one, one bit of concentration.
You're reminding me of your poem, The Student, where it begins, my poetry instruction book.
Right, right. Yeah.
Would you read that? It's on 51 of the galley, in any case.
Okay.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Billy Collins. We're talking about The Trouble with Poetry and Other Poems, published by Random House.
The poem is called The Student. My poetry instruction book, which I bought at an outdoor stall along the river, contains many rules about what to avoid and what to follow. More than two people in a poem is a crowd, is one. Mention what clothes you are wearing as you compose is another. Avoid the word vortex, the word velvety, and the word cicada. When at a loss for an ending, have some brown hens standing in the rain. Never admit that you revise, and always keep your poem in one season. I try to be mindful, but in these last days of summer, whenever I look up from my page and see a burn mark of yellow leaves, I think of the icy winds that will soon be knifing through my jacket.
I love how that poem ends, and I love how so many of your poems end. They simply end.
Well, they don't. Yeah, I think you don't want to conclude.
Right.
A really bad way to begin the last stanza is with the phrase "in conclusion." Yeah, you want, and it's better. I mean, I think as a younger poet, I tried to go for the big ending. And I think Elizabeth Bishop says that there's a point in a poem where it begins to end. And pretty much every poet knows this. You know that this is the last little bit, the last sentence, or the last stanza, the last comment. And at that point, lots of things can go wrong because you sit up a little bit higher in your chair and you stick your chin out and here you're gonna throw this fantastic ending on the poem. And if you have that kind of change of attitude, you often ruin the tone of the whole poem that you've developed so far. So it's better to have, I think, when in doubt, have a low-key ending where which could just be an image, a kind of, you know, you give the reader an image and let the reader figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The lanyard is one of my favorites in this book. I'm just so curious about this, and I wonder if you would read it.
Sure. It's a summertime poem. This is a phenomenon that takes place with American youth during the summer. Excuse me. It's called The Lanyard. The other day, as I was ricocheting slowly off the pale blue walls of this room, bouncing from typewriter to piano, from bookshelf to an envelope lying on the floor, I found myself in the L section of the dictionary, where my eyes fell upon the word lanyard. No cookie nibbled by a French novelist could send one more suddenly into the past, a past where I sat at a workbench at a camp by a deep Adirondack lake, learning how to braid thin plastic strips into a lanyard, a gift for my mother. I had never seen anyone use a lanyard, or wear one, if that's what you did with them, but that did not keep me from crossing strand over strand again and again until I had made a boxy red and white lanyard for my mother. She gave me life and milk from her breasts, and I gave her a lanyard. She nursed me in many a sick room, lifted teaspoons of medicine to my lips, set cold face cloths on my forehead, and then led me out into the airy light and taught me to walk and swim, and I in turn presented her with a lanyard. Here are thousands of meals, she said, and here is clothing and a good education. And here is your lanyard, I replied, which I made with a little help from a counselor. Here is a breathing body and a beating heart, strong legs, bones and teeth, and two clear eyes to read the world, she whispered. And here, I said, is the lanyard I made at camp. And here, I wish to say to her now, is a smaller gift, not the archaic truth that you can never repay your mother, but the rueful admission that when she took the two-tone lanyard from my hands, I was as sure as a boy could be that this useless, worthless thing I wove out of boredom would be enough to make us even.
That's such a wonderful poem. I'll tell you, it's so emotional, and I'm wondering about the writing of it. Do you feel emotional when you write poems, or are you coming from more of a sort of rational, logical, kind of imagistic place where it's coming and it is what it is?
I don't feel emotional at all. No, I feel emotional, you know, before and after and at plenty of other times. But in writing a poem, it's not, you need to concentrate. You can't afford to be emotional. You need to concentrate on the nuts and bolts details of what you're doing, which is making lines, creating stanzas, making images, all of the kind of carpentry, as W.H. Auden put it, of constructing a poem. The emotion toward my mother is there, you know, but it's certainly not welling up while I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also an example of, you know, if you want to write about something big like your mother, what can be bigger? You can't take her on directly. You need to find some little thing, like little keyhole or aperture, like a lanyard, something small that will lead you into this big thing. I mean, I couldn't sit down. If I sat down and wrote my gratitude toward my mother, an ode, you know, I wouldn't be able to get much farther than that. I'd quit. But I actually, the beginning of the poem is true to fact. I mean, I was poking around in the dictionary, and I came across that word, and it, like Proust's Madeleine that I kind of slyly referred to in the second stanza about the French novelist, it just triggered this big memory of my youth and being at camp and making this thing for my mom.
And the details of this poem and of your poems just really, I don't know, just give the poem life and emotion and more than, yeah, if you said, you know, what a wonderful woman.
Yeah. what a gal. Well, that's because, I mean, I guess it's the, I don't know. I mean, the details are, you don't want to say the emotion. You want to dramatize it. And the way to do that is through objects and scenes and images and of clouds and lanyards and teaspoons of medicine and all of those. Because the things of the world, you know, a medicine bottle or a lanyard or a frisbee or a sugar bowl, whatever the object is, it has a story, it has resonance. And all of these things, I mean, Romantic poets had a vocabulary of cloud and tree and rock and river and sky, and more contemporary poets have a more variegated set of images of refrigerator and coffee pot and white wall tire, whatever it is. But all of these things have, they speak, you know, they're able to speak for themselves, and they don't need decoration. I mean, I think as a starting out poet, most people tend to over-decorate the poems, and they think, well, this noun can't get along without me. You know, I can't just say chair. I have to, like, have five adjectives to let the reader know this is my chair. But chair is just fine. You know, chair has been there, and the chair will be there after we're gone. And it's sort of a respect for the object world around us. It really doesn't need our decorative skills.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am here today with Billy Collins, author of many books, the most current one being The Trouble with Poetry and Other Poems. How did being poet laureate, U.S. poet laureate, change your life, your writing life? Or
it,
did it?
Well, it's just about just brought it to an end. Because I must preface this by saying it's a delight to talk to you, but when I was poet laureate, I was it seemed I was the first Christian martyr to be interviewed to death. You know, I feel like St. Stephen was, instead of arrows, would be microphones. But or Sebastian, I guess it is. But I started to. This kind of you know, old paranoia came back, and I started thinking, well, maybe the poet laureateship is a kind of government plot to, like, pick out one poet who seems to be doing really well and then silence them for a year because of so many interviews and other obligations. I don't know. It was a pretty heady experience. It's really good for your self-esteem. I'll say that for it. I'll admit to, like, you know, a couple of days where I'd, you know, it's raining out and I got a flat tire or something, you know, the dog's flaring up, and I would say to myself, well, you know, you're poet laureate of the United States. I mean, how bad can this day really be? You know, it was something to sort of hold on to, but I don't know. It, you know, you don't have to do much as poet laureate, as you probably know, but it does enable you to. It gives you the power to, you know, launch these initiatives. So I launched this initiative called Poetry 180, which
yes.
was a way of infiltrating high schools with contemporary poetry.
You know, actually, I think you have been the most visible and active poet laureate ever because of that initiative. And you're just all over the place. You know, turn on Prairie Home Companion, and there you are with Garrison Keillor going on. And it's great.
Yeah, well, NPR is a terrific outlet for poetry. It's a really amazing way to showcase poetry, because there's an instant audience of 2 to 3 million people hearing a poem.
Interesting. Okay, speaking of poems, one of the poems in this book I found really amusing was The Revenant.
Uh-huh.
Will you read that? It's on 65 of the galley that I'm holding.
Sure. I've written a lot about dogs. I have a dog, and I've had lots of dogs, and when I don't have a dog, I always feel like I'm between dogs. I'm, you know, ready for the next one. So in this case, I was trying to write a poem about a dog from a very, very strange angle. It's called The Revenant. I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come back to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you, not one bit. When I licked your face, I thought of biting off your nose. When I watched you toweling yourself dry, I wanted to leap and unman you with a snap. I resented the way you moved, your lack of animal grace, the way you would sit in a chair to eat, a napkin on your lap, knife in your hand. I would have run away, but I was too weak, a trick you taught me while I was learning to sit and heal, and greatest of insults, shake hands without a hand. I admit the sight of the leash would excite me, but only because it meant I was about to smell things you had never touched. You do not want to believe this, but I have no reason to lie. I hated the car, hated the rubber toys, disliked your friends, and worse, your relatives. The jingling of my tags drove me mad. You always scratched me in the wrong place. All I ever wanted from you was food and fresh water in my metal bowls. While you slept, I watched you breathe as the moon rose in the sky. It took all of my strength not to raise my head and howl. Now I am free of the collar, the yellow raincoat, monogram sweater, the absurdity of your lawn. And that is all you need to know about this place, except what you already supposed and are glad it did not happen sooner, that everyone here can read and write, the dogs in poetry, the cats and all the others in prose.
That's wonderful.
You can tell my prejudice there. That poem has a way of, you know, driving cat lovers crazy.
Yeah, and all the others in prose.
Yeah, just, I mean, the llamas, the, you know, the jackals, the rhinoceri or whatever. They're all hacks. You know, they're writing journalism, and the dogs are writing poetry.
What did your dog think of that one?
She just cocks her head as usual. God bless her.
We have a couple of minutes left with Billy Collins, author of The Trouble with Poetry and Other Poems, published by Random House. Oh, what, you know, any last words for the writers listening, for the poets listening? Anything you'd like to tell them?
For poets to read poetry, you the only way you learn to write is not by going to class, but by reading other poets. Those are the best teachers. I suppose, you know, writing poetry is kind of a way of stepping out of the self, the way we do when we make conversation, when we play a sport. I mean, we're kind of stepping out of the self and announcing ourselves. Even when we, you know, if a woman wears perfume or if you smoke a cigarette, you're kind of extending the self into a little area beyond you, outside of your physical boundaries. And to make a poem is to kind of try to make a lasting thing that will talk not just to the present, where our words tend to evaporate as we speak them, but you're talking to something broader. Not just posterity, but you are kind of talking to the future. You're making something, you're hoping to make something that will keep talking after you're dead. So that they won't be able to shut you up. Right? I mean, they can close the coffin, but somewhere in some library, that your words will still be yakking away.
Mm. Well, thank you once again.
What a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been great talking to you.
Thanks.
Thank you. That was Billy Collins, author of The Trouble with poetry and other poems published by Random House, talking to us from New York. When we return, we will be with Michael Larson, literary agent in San Francisco, who has a new book out. So please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
If a Middle Earth elf lived today in Southern California, how would she celebrate and support the arts, music, and her community? What would Arwen do? Thursdays, 4 to 5 p.m. with me, Tani Tenuvio, on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live at kuci.org. Ellen Salalumin Amenti Alfa.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're also podcasting these days, and if you want to hear past shows, what you need to do is go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. That will take you to the radio page, and you'll find information on the show, the current schedule, but you also see links to the podcasts, and it's a great way to catch up. There's probably five dozen shows up at this point. Every week, a couple more. Okay, we're going to continue on with Michael Larson. He's a literary agent in San Francisco with his wife, Elizabeth Pomata, And his website, if you want to check it out, is larsenpomada.com, LarsenPomada.com. You can find out all sorts of information about his agency and the sorts of books that he and Elizabeth represent. He's also an author of a few books. One is How to Write a Book Proposal, which I recommend all the time to my students and to anybody who talks to me about wanting to write a book and how do they do that. It was the proposal. It was the book I actually used to write my proposal for Pen on Fire that did get published by Harcourt. And it's a wonderful book. And he also has literary agents, what they do, how they do it, and how to find one and work with the right one for you. And his new book is How to Get a Literary Agent. Let's bring him on. Hi, Michael.
Greetings. Hi there.
Great to have you on.
Well, I appreciate being here.
Yeah.
Very kind of you.
Talk to us about this, your new book, How to Get a Literary Agent.
Actually, How to Get a Literary Agent is the third edition of the agent book. The first title you mentioned is the previous edition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just come out, How to Get a Literary Agent, from Sourcebooks. And I've tried to make it, up to date, and there's more technology in it than there was in the previous edition.
Sure.
Because that's just so important.
Well, I think, too, you being a literary agent, you have kind of the firsthand sort of information on what works and what doesn't work.
Exactly. And that's something that the agents can do for writers, the writers can't do for themselves, and that is understand editorial sensibilities and the most effective way to present things to them.
So what are some of the things that you see writers doing that are really big no-nos when they say approach you and hope for representation?
Yes. Well, Kate Medina, who's one of the top editors at Random House, once said that writers are often guilty of what she calls premature omission. They send material out, proposals and manuscripts, which really aren't ready to be sold. It's really crucial that a proposal or manuscript to be 100% as good as it can possibly be before it's submitted to agents or publishers. It's tremendously important, and writers aren't in the best position to know that, which is why they really need to get feedback from other writers.
Yeah. Yeah, writers are very anxious to get published.
Yes, exactly. That's the problem. And they're sometimes more anxious to get published than they are to make sure their books are 100% before they try and sell them.
Yeah.
The fate of a proposal or manuscript is sealed with the envelope with which it's put into the mail. What the agent, editor, publisher, and deal authors get for books determines on what editors and agents see. What writers get depends on what agents and editors see. So it's just crucial that they make their work 100% before they submit it. Agents and editors only read far enough to make a decision. That could even come in the query letter if it's not well written. So that's a really huge thing. The other piece for me, because I do nonfiction in the agency and Elizabeth does the fiction, is promotion. I'm kind of a prisoner of the literary industrial complex. I can only hope to make a living by selling books to the six conglomerates that dominate trade publishing. And if it's a how-to book or a book dependent on author promotion, an author's platform, most common words in publishing, is really important. Their ability to go around the country and give talks and be visible on a continuing basis in the media or through talks.
And that's a big part of the book proposal, the nonfiction book proposal.
Indeed. Yeah. It's not true for, like, memoirs or serious literary books or scientific books, but for how-to kinds of books, for books for a wide national audience, the promotion for which has to be author-driven, driven by talks or media, it's really crucial. And the challenge for new writers is that they tend not to have all the promotional ammunition that big houses need. It's still publishable, but it'll be by a medium-sized house or a small house, not
yeah.
a big one.
Yeah. So what are the things that you see that you love that come in the door?
Does it
matter what color the envelope is?
I know. Well, there's two elements in a submission, the author and whatever the author's submitting. For authors, I'd love to see people that have had media experience.
authors who've already built their platform by having some kind of continuing national media visibility or giving talks around the country. I love to see fresh ideas, as do editors. One way to look at the challenge of writing a book is one metaphor to use is like it's new. Ideally, it should be new wine in a new bottle. Mm-hmm. New information presented in a fresh way that you can put on the title and maybe even have some cover art, something. So most books tend to be another book on a subject rather than something new. But editors love to find fresh ideas. And, of course, the quality of the writing. Editors are suckers for good writing, as are agents. They become agents and editors because they love writing. And it's great when they see something and they know right away a person can write. Especially that's true for fiction. I mean, I have what I call the five S's for the first page of a novel. A style, story, setting, someone, or something else must be compelling on the first page. Agents or editors are only reading far enough to make a decision. And more than 90% of the time, that decision is no.
Mm-hmm.
So it's whatever's sent out to them's got to be impeccable.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Michael Larson, author of How to Get a Literary Agent, How to Write a Book Proposal, and he's a literary agent in San Francisco. What about self-published books? How do they affect you? If somebody says, well, I am published, I've self-published a book, and here's my second proposal for a book. I mean, do you feel one way or another? Does producing a self-published book make you feel that the writer is persevering? Does it how do they make you feel, or does it depend on the book itself? Will you take a look at it and
our most successful nonfiction author is a guy named Jay Levinson, not a name that most people know, but they always recognize the phrase guerrilla marketing.
Yes.
I got started with Jay in like 1977 because he self-published a book called Earning Money Without a Job,
mm-hmm.
The Economics of Freedom. There's a story about him in the Chronicle, and I called him and sold it to Holtz, which still publishes it. And then he went on to write what are now more than 25, or co-author more than 25 guerrilla marketing books. Did virtually endless series. What was your question, Barbara?
How does self-published books affect you?
Self-publishing, yeah. I think, is a really helpful thing. In fact, one could say of authors that they have three basic options. If they want to be published by a big house and their idea is strong enough, their writing is strong enough, and their promotion plan is strong enough, then they can approach big houses or agents who want to sell to big houses. If they don't, they have two alternatives. Either they take the time to build a platform, create the promotional ammunition they need to approach big houses, or they go for a medium and small-sized house. Self-publishing is a great way to test market a book, as is talks and as are articles. Write an article and write a magazine will sell a book. So test marketing is a very powerful tool. And even if a writer has a publisher, if they're giving talks, as soon as they have a finished manuscript, they can stick that thing in a loose-leaf binder and sell it for $20 to get feedback on it. Tremendously valuable feedback, both on the reader's experience of reading it and also the effect it has on their lives, if that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So self-publishing is a great way to test market a book. Absolutely.
And then how does that differ from print-on-demand in terms
That's one of the ways to do it. I look at it, I think ideally it has two stages. The first is taking the double-spaced manuscript, asking people to mark it up and send it back.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're giving talks, integrate changes into the next version of the manuscript and then just print up enough for each talk.
Mm-hmm.
So you keep improving it.
Sure.
And then when people stop giving you helpful feedback, then it's time to think about taking it to the next step, which could be print-on-demand. Online publishers that either that'll publish it for free or for less than $1,000, they'll digitize it and make it available both as a download and also as a print-on-demand book. Another great way to test market a book. If authors sell enough copies of their books, regardless of how they're self-published, agents and editors will come looking for them.
Well, what's enough copies? What would be a good number?
I don't know that there's a number. One editor once said to us, "Well, if a book sells 2,000 copies a month for 8 months, I want to see it."
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's still that promotion thing. Editors, publishers really want authors going to go out and promote their books. So that's a really important piece of it, whether or not a book is self-published.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the same, as you said earlier, it's not exactly the same for fiction writers in terms of being visible, being, you know, having a platform. Or is it? I mean, are fiction writers asked...
It's not the same, and it's harder. I mean, at the beginning of their careers, nonfiction writers are luckier than novelists in a lot of ways. And one of the ways is this business about creating a platform. Novelists don't usually have much of a platform, which isn't to say they can't. Sandy Dykstra found Amy Tan because she had a short story in Zisifa, San Francisco Literary Magazine. That's kind of a platform, getting short stories published.
Sure.
Teaching writing or research or talking at writers' conferences or certainly attending them, winning contests. So there's ways that writers can, novelists can build platforms. It's just peculiar to things that they can do as novelists. But that's very important. Do they have an MFA? That can be helpful. The conferences they've attended. Of course, prizes and awards, as I said. But editors who do not, fiction want writers who are out there somewhat, not just sitting behind their desk and have turned out this manuscript. They want something to start with.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want total neophytes.
Yes. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Michael Larson, author of How to Get a Literary Agent, How to Write a Book Proposal, and other books. And he's a literary agent in San Francisco. His website is larsonpomada.com. What about the memoir form? What do you see happening with it? Especially, well, I don't know. I don't know. It seems like it's as popular as ever, that the Fry debacle didn't really... dull its, the quantity of memoirs coming out. What do you see going on with that genre?
Well, it's true for all kinds of books, and that is that the more that are published in an area, the different and better new ones have to be. It was Angela's Ashes that unleashed a wave of memoirs, its success. And it's an ongoing kind of subject. Nobody's going to stop publishing memoirs, but somehow they have to thread their way and be, you know, get onto shelves and stay on shelves, either because of the writing or the content, or ideally both, and because of an author's visibility. So I think that's the challenge. Those shelves, all shelves in bookstores are now full, and if one wants to be published by a big house, then they have an idea now it's going to get to bookstore shelves 18 months to 2 years from now. So they have to think ahead as well. So having a great story to tell and making it read like a novel is going to be extremely important. It's all about the writing.
Mm-hmm.
All about the writing.
Hmm. So trends. Writers are, you know, we are taught to, or at least told, to read industry magazines, to read Publishers Weekly, to read Publishers Lunch, to understand what's happening in the writing business. And yet... how wise is that really on the level for writing, you know, because then you're in your office or you're at your desk writing and you're thinking, well, is this going to sell and what's the marketplace going to do with this and what about trends? What do you think? Do you think writers should pay a whole lot of attention to trends and marketplace?
Yes. But it can be hard to tell from what's on bookstore shelves and what people see on bestseller lists. I think the way that writers should look, whether they're writing fiction or nonfiction, is look where the culture is going and some things that aren't going to change things that are going to stay with us. Michael Korda did a book about bestseller lists, and he said they haven't changed much in 100 years. There's still the same mix of those perennial subjects, sex, money, power, God, politics. So those are enduring, endless, timeless subjects. At the same time, I think there's some really, it's an amazing time to be alive. And there are some cultural trends that are going to be with us. One, for example, is the media of East and West. This is going to be certainly the Pacific century, probably the Chinese century. So there's going to be interest in multicultural subjects. And what you've seen, been growing over the last decade certainly, is putting together East and West in kind of lifestyle subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Fitness, exercise, just a world of subjects that relate to how one lives. And people are very, very open to it. Or maybe we're spoiled because we're in California. But there's going to be growing interest in the Pacific Rim and subjects that, lifestyle kinds of subjects, which have always been an interest, but are now being kind of given an Eastern twist when that's possible. So.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, I think writers just obsess on all that. You know, what should I be writing? What will give me the most likelihood of getting published? Especially maybe in writing nonfiction. I think with fiction, you are drawn to a certain genre of fiction, whether it be, oh, I don't know, romance, literary, mystery, and that's what you must do.
Well, but I think I think that's true in a way for nonfiction as well. I think one of the keys to being a successful writer is to practice niche craft. Find a niche, find a subject or kind of novel that you will enjoy writing and will enjoy promoting, and that lends itself to a series of books, and build a career around it.
Mm.
Just like Jay Levinson had 25 books on guerrilla marketing.
Yeah.
You know, Sue Grafton is working her way from A to Z in the alphabet, right? Janet Ivanovich's books can really be infinite because they're about numbers. So that's really important because you can build a career book by book, city by city, talk by talk. It's a way to build a career. And writers are doing it all the time.
Hmm.
So it's a very powerful idea. Yeah. It's more of a challenge when writers want to do both fiction and nonfiction, or they have a whole bunch of different ideas, unrelated ideas they write to us about. That just tells us they don't really know who they are yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's important.
Or if they perhaps need a little too much feedback from you. I don't know if writers ever send in proposals or queries and say, well, but tell me what you think, and where do you think this should go? To me,
Not an agent's job.
Right.
I've tried to make my books and our website as helpful as possible to new writers. We're out there, and what our listings and directories, what we want is clear, and what we need to see is clear. So, you know, write a one sentence something, Barbara, and a manuscript, and he hadn't even read it. He just typed it up and sent it out. You know? So, it's a challenge. You know, Shaw was right when he said that every profession is a conspiracy against the laity. You know, publishing is a business with its own jargon, its own ways of doing things. It's another world. And so it's really important that writers get a sense of what that world is like by attending events and reading books. And you mentioned Publisher's Lunch, a great and free daily newsletter, right?
Yes.
At publisherslunch.com, and publishersweekly.com also has a free daily newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, one of the many reasons why now is the best time ever to be a writer is that there's more sources of information than ever to help writers. A lot of them are online. Which I say knowing that there's so much good stuff online now that's affecting the sales of writing books.
Mm-hmm.
But also, no matter what one wants to write, there are more models to follow than ever. One doesn't have to figure out how to write a mystery. Read enough of them and you'll know.
Right.
But that's true for nonfiction books as well, of course. In terms of the subjects, the length of books, there's sort of been a trend toward shorter books because they're cheaper, take less time to read. The length, the back matter, the use of anecdotes, illustrations. All those models are out there for writers to follow.
So what about, so many writers are hearing that it's really, you know, tougher than ever to publish fiction. How does your agency see that?
Well, it's tougher for new writers to get anything published by New York publishers. Their expectations keep rising, and the more they rise, the less able new writers are to get published by them with their first books. I think models are what writers have to use to get through that. It is harder, but one of the ways in which novelists can make clear what they're doing is through what they call the Hollywood pitch. So it's Tom Jones meets the Three Musketeers or whatever. Coming up with an idea that immediately places the book in the literary landscape and makes it sound commercial.
Mm-hmm.
I think writers really novelists have to have really clear visions of where they want their books to go in a bookstore shelf.
Mm-hmm.
To make their books ideally better than the books that have already been published. To look at the successful books like the novels they want to write is kind of benchmarks for them to improve on. They need to do the same thing, but only do it differently and better.
Mm. Always.
I'm not talking about selling their souls to the marketplace to make a living or just being calculated. Whatever they do has to come from the heart. It's got to be authentic because readers will know immediately if it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's not either or. It's really about balancing both. It's really about balancing art and commerce. The writer with something to say and the writer with something to sell. I mean, at the heart of building a career as a writer is writing books that readers like so much that they'll want to read every book the author writes.
Yes.
And they've got to make that heart connection as well as that head connection with authors and books. So that's the way to think about that challenge.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show again. It's always interesting to talk with you. And as I said, I recommend How to Write a Book Proposal, your book, all the time. It was so useful to me in getting my book published. So.
Well, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Many, many thanks for having me on, Barbara.
Thanks so much.
You take care.
That was Michael Larson, author of How to Get a Literary Agent, How to Write a Book Proposal, and other books. And he's a literary agent in San Francisco. That's it for today. Next week, Carolyn C., author of There Will Never Be Another You, will be with me. And I think that's it. If you need to know more, go to my website, penonfire.com. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Carl Sandburg, the poet. And he said, "Poetry is the journal of the sea animal living on land, wanting to fly in the air. Poetry is a search for syllables to shoot at the barriers of the unknown and the unknowable. Poetry is a phantom script telling how rainbows are made and why they go away." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.